Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Richard Skipper celebrates the best in entertainment. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique. Never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Wednesday, everyone, and welcome to the latest edition of Richard Skipper Celebrates. For those of you who are here for the first time, welcome. My show is all about celebrating. Celebrating art, celebrating artists, celebrating life. I believe that there truly is a lot to celebrate if we only take the time to do so. And we have to find the time to do so, especially in this crazy world that we're living in right now. If this is your first time here, I hope that thank you for being here, first of all. And I hope that you will enjoy today's show. It's not gossipy. We're going to be celebrating Davis Gaines' incredible career, his life. There's so many things. I am so glad that he's right here right now. Davis, before we jump into your life and career, because I'm all about celebrating, I want to ask you, what are you celebrating right now?
That I'm alive during the, like, that I'm still here, actually. This past 18 months has been, for all of us, just the deepest, darkest time, especially for performers like we are. Like, that's what we do. It's like I lost a leg or an arm, or, you know, I don't feel like I am who I really am without being on stage or being, or performing or singing or whatever. But I just feel like it's been a very tough time for especially theater people, you know? So I'm celebrating that we almost got through the hump, I hope.
Yeah, well, those of us who are in the business, March 12th, last year, everything shut down. What did your calendar look like when everything shut down last year?
I was doing, on March 10th, I was doing a reading of a new musical up at the Rubicon Theater in Ventura. Mm-hmm. And that night, we knew something was crazy going on. And I literally just walked out the stage door that night and drove home and really never left. My mom and my sister were coming out from Orlando for my sister's spring break. She teaches school. So they were going to arrive around March 12th, 13th for a week. And then the NBA shut down. I went, this is pretty serious. So then they didn't come. And I just sat home for a long time. So, yeah.
Now, were you hearing any rumblings about this thing called COVID before this actually happened? Or did it hit you like a ton of bricks?
In January, I heard. We were making kind of fun of it. I was my dear, dear friend, Joy Abbott, the wife of George Abbott. Mm-hmm. Had cancer, and she didn't have long to be with us. So she lived in Miami Beach. So I was in Miami Beach to see her, and it was the Super Bowl weekend too. So everybody was out and about, but we were talking about this crazy thing that was over there coming, and we were kind of making fun of it, like Corona beer, coronavirus. We didn't, what is it? But then it just started getting bigger and bigger and bigger, I've been on top of it ever since. I just, I read the news and watch the news a lot. So I knew what was coming before a lot of people did.
Now, you grew up in Orlando, Florida. As a little boy growing up in Orlando, I'm sure you were hearing about this, about the fact that Walt Disney World was going to be coming there. And just this past week, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of Walt Disney World opening. And you happened to be at Walt Disney World the very first day that it opened. Am I correct?
I am. I was in high school. It was my first high school job. And I had to audition for, I remember, for the character department. And the auditions for that were, you know, I was already wanted to be an actor at that point, from way before that. But it was my chance to audition for, you know, big time show business. So I, you had to like skip down the floor and wave. And that was, and, you know, I don't know. And I got the gig and I was in high, that was my first job in high school. And,
And you started at the top, if I may add. It, you know, there's a song, it's not where you start, it's where you finish. And you ended up on the cover of Life magazine. And here, and I want to see if anyone can figure out where you are. See, I do my research. Yes. So if I'm not mistaken, aren't you Winnie the Pooh?
Yes, in that one. Yes. The characters are all cast by their height. Right. In Winnie's costume back then, I think it's changed now, but your head is up basically in the honey jar. And so, and there was a string that you used to pull to make his ears wiggle. So that wasn't my normal character, but that day there, I just had.
I think this was your normal character.
Yeah, that's Jay Worthington Faufo from Pinocchio. And oddly enough, the song he sings in the movie is "Hi Diddly Dee, An Actor's Life." So it all came full circle back to.
Well, I want to talk about that for a moment. Going back a little further, I always like to go back to the five-year-old self. For me, the five-year-old self is the purest self. That's literally before school starts. Peer pressure. You go to school. Other kids start shaping you as to who you should be or who should not be. Even teachers start shaping you as to who you should be and who you should not be. Tell us a little bit about the five-year-old Davis Gaines.
Well, first of all, I was very, very shy, bullied, kind of introvert, kind of I loved my record player and my records. So I spent a lot of time in my room with my music, and I think that's why I the singing came naturally, and I love that. Then in junior high school, I had this amazing drama teacher who changed my life. Her name was Ann Derflinger, and she saw my before that. I've read in the newspaper in Orlando that there was a children's theater opening up, and my parents were out of town, and I convinced my grandparents to drive me to this place. And I joined this, it was called the Peter Pan Playhouse. And it was this guy named Johnny Mayo. And it was all kids like me who wanted to be in the theater. And he turned his house into a theater, and we go there, we learn how to breathe and project, and we do shows there, and then we take the shows to elementary schools around this city, and I loved it. I loved that. And
do you have any inkling where that came from? I mean, obviously you're an introverted kid, you're listening to these cast recordings in your bedroom, but it's one thing to have this inner world going on. We have a mutual friend that we're going to talk about in a few moments. And she talked also, and we'll mention her name a little later, about as an only child, creating this fantasy world in her own bedroom when she was growing up, and creating these fantasy characters. And then that was the genesis of creating this massive, incredible career that she had. And then stepping out into the world and making it happen and manifesting that. But stepping into that light, where did that come from for you? Were you a child of television? What was your first experience seeing a live show? Where did that come from for you?
Oh, all these questions, Richard. You're good at this. Because I think I was so introverted and whatever, I found that I could become someone, another character. I could become someone else besides myself. And you know, become a character. And people would respond to the character in a positive way. People, when I was on stage and playing someone else but me, they would like me. And so I became, it kind of, I blossomed that way. That's where I felt most comfortable. Mm-hmm. And that's how I think I wanted to be an actor to begin with, because I like to, you know, just to be invisible. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but it was great. And that opened myself up. And I think then I got more confidence. And then I just, that's all I wanted to do. And I didn't know how to do it, because Orlando was, you know, before Disney. So there was nothing, I had no mentor, nothing except the Johnny Mayo and then my junior high school drama teacher, Ann Derflinger, who gave me support and pushed me in that direction, because I guess they saw something in me that I had this fire. And I guess, you know, it is, if you don't have it.
That's right. But God bless grandparents, because grandparents will get you there. What was your parents feeling when they found out that your grandparents had taken you there? Were they responding?
My parents thought they're very supportive. They've always been very supportive. But I think in the beginning, like college age, they thought, or before college, they thought it was just a phase I was going through. Mm-hmm. Get over it and become a doctor or whatever. But then they accepted that this is what I wanted to do. And so they were also very supportive in taking me and my sisters to New York when I was, you know, 10 years old, eight and 10. I think they did it for me. And my first Broadway show, I saw Oliver, and then I was hooked, and I wanted to be one of those boys up there. And I couldn't turn back. I just loved it. But I never thought that I would end up there, but that was, I manifested it, I guess.
Absolutely. But what was the point in which you started to map out a career for yourself?
Well, I knew I had to go. I majored in theater at Florida State. There was not musical theater at that point, but theater. And then I just knew I had to go to New York. I didn't know. That's where I knew I had to do that. I knew no one. And I got there by myself in an empty apartment. And
I always love those stories. How did you make the trip to New York? How did you get here?
I had gone up to visit a friend of mine, Debbie McLeod. She had already graduated from Florida State the same time I did, but I didn't go right after. She went. She got into a touring production of Spoon River Anthology.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Of a theater like in Midtown. And I went up to see it, and they were going on tour. And I went back to Florida, and I got a call that somebody dropped out and would I want to come up and join the tour. So I joined that tour and toured the country with that show for a few months. And then they dumped me in New York, and that's how I got there.
Can you give us the gauge of about approximately what time this frame this was?
Wow. It was probably like the late 70s.
Okay. I'm not asking to give your age away. I'm asking because of what New York was like at that time, because it was a very different world than what it is right now. So was this an equity production or what was the show that you got your equity card with?
It was with Goodspeed Opera House.
Oh, wow.
I did two shows there, but I think it was She Loves Me, which is still one of my favorite shows. Mm-hmm. And I did She Loves Me and Bloomer Girl there. But I got my equity card because that's back then you could just go in and audition and get your card right away. So, yeah, I got that. Marty Rolfe. Do you remember her?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, she was Amalia. And who was the original girl? Rita Gardner?
Oh, my God. Rita Gardner. Okay.
The other person in She Loves Me, the second lead lady in that.
In the original?
Speed production.
Okay.
Rita Gardner was in it. That one. It's crazy.
So, you know, after you got your equity card, was that a hindrance for you at that time, or were doors starting to open for you? Because for some actors, if you get the equity card too soon, you know, it can be a roadblock. What was it in your case?
No, it was a good thing. Yeah, it helped me. It helped me get work. Now I understand nowadays, I tell kids that maybe you don't want to get it right now because of, there's a lot of great non-equity work that you can do, especially out here in LA, that they can work and get their points or whatever they do. But no, I was happy to get that. And
now, has there ever been, you know, looking at your career, and I mean, you know, you've done over 2,000 performances as the Phantom. I mean, what a feat there. And of course, touring with our mutual friend, Carol Channing. And, you know, talk about longevity and mapping out a career. And I want to talk about some of the life lessons that you learned from her as, you know, we go on. But was there ever a period in your career that was a truly low point for you in terms of excluding COVID, of course, that was a long period of being without work? And what got you through that period?
There's been many times, and I think I'm not the only person, actor, that's been in this position, but yeah, like sometimes I can't pinpoint exactly when it was in the career, but like, what's the point? I got to do something. I can't wait around or can't. Right. Yeah, of course I've been there thinking about, I'm going to do something else or quit. But then I would tell people that and they go, oh no, you can't quit. And it's like, why not? I mean, why not? Well, you can't stop doing this. Well, if no one's going to hire me, then what the hell? So yeah, I've been there. Definitely. The time when I did a lot of ensemble work, which I was very proud of, and I learned a lot. I encourage people to be in the ensemble before they play roles because you learn all sides of the business. And up until Camelot, I got Camelot with Richard Burton and Christine Ebersole. And I was in the ensemble, but I became friends with both Christine, of course, and then Richard Burton. And Richard Mewins was playing Lancelot during that tour. That was my first Broadway thing. And I remember sitting on a bus with him one day and saying, I want to do what you do. I'm going to play Lancelot. I want to play roles. And he gave me this advice about, well, what you need to do is, playing in the ensemble is easy for you. You can get that anytime. And you're good at it. But sometimes they peg you, they put you in that little box that's all you can do. So he gave me this advice of not taking any more ensemble jobs and just wait till a role came along. And sure enough, I did that. And then the next thing was, of course, in Hello Dolly. So from that point, from Cornelius, then it just went forward.
Was there a long gap of time between the two?
Not really, actually. Okay. I just got lucky. And then wasn't Carol's book called
I'm Just Lucky, I Guess?
Yeah.
And you know why she called it Just Lucky, I Guess?
Well, I read it once, but why?
Well, she says it's like, you know, when they asked her, you know, why did you call the book Just Lucky, I Guess? It's like, you know, the client says to the prostitute, how did you get into this profession? Just lucky, I guess.
I feel that about me. I don't know. It's a little kid from Orlando. And I often say, what? Why me? And then this always goes back to Carol for some reason. At Carol's memorial service in Palm Springs, it was a thrill and an honor to be there.
Yes, I was there for that. Yes.
Beautiful. And to sing and talk about her. But during the sound check, I was in the wings with Tyne Daly. Mm-hmm. And we were both just like, we were waiting for our turn. And We're just saying, looking at the pictures of all of her on her pictures and the costumes on the stage. And we were talking about how fortunate we thought we were and how lucky that we thought we were to be there that day. And she said, yeah, I just feel, you know, I got to be at the golden age of television with Cagney and Lacey, and I got to be on Broadway Gypsy. And I got to work with so many amazing people in my life. And then I told her, I said, often I would think, I just said, I often think, why me? And she put her hand on my chest and said, why not you?
Exactly. Exactly.
It was like a light bulb moment that I wish I had had 30 years ago, because it was like, wow, that's the first time I ever heard that or owned that or accepted that. So it was, why not you?
One of the articles that I read when I was researching to get ready for this, and I may be paraphrasing, so forgive me if I do, but you said it was almost like a pinball machine, your career. You know, the people that you've met, and I mean, that you've met these people along the way, you plan a career, but, you know, like even listening to the records in your room, and that you got the chance to sing with some of these people, you got the chance to meet these people, you got a chance to work with these people. I mean, when I think growing up, I grew up in South Carolina, and, you know, I'm a product of 1960s and 70s television. On any given night, as I'm channel surfing, so many people that have become friends of mine, some that have passed on, some, thank God, that are still with us. As I'm channel surfing, there they are on television. And I go, I can't believe.
I know that person. Yes, I know. It's
really weird. This person is a friend of mine. And I don't take it lightly. I don't say this in a braggadocious way. One thing that Tyne said, do you remember what she said about Carol's passing? To always think of her as being in the next room.
Nice.
And, you know, and that resonated so strongly with us. But because Carol left such a strong impression on all of us, that, you know, we do think of her as being left. But I want to talk about some of the people along the way. You mentioned earlier George Abbott. What are some of the life lessons that you learned from George Abbott, not only as an artist, but things that he has imparted that you've taken into your personal life as well?
Well, first of all, I don't think I would have ever met Hal Prince or been the Phantom without meeting George Abbott. And when I met him, he was 99 years old. And he, I had done Angelo Del Rossi, a Paper Mill Playhouse.
Oh my God. So oh, dear friend.
Yes. I had already done Joseph and the Amazing Coat there for him. And Tony Tanner directed that production of it, and it was great. And then I did a play there with Tony Randall and Millicent Martin and Paxton Whitehead. It was a Ray Cooney farce. And so I had done that play and the musical. And then he called me and said, we're going to do Damn Yankees, and George Abbott's going to direct it. And I went, what? And so I was so excited. And I learned all the, you know, Joe Hardy's music, and just was like, had my little folder in my book. And it was at the Minskoff rehearsal studios. And I walked in this giant room, and at the very end was a table with Angelo and Mr. Abbott, sitting, just the two of them. And I walked the walk down to the thing, and I shook his hand. So proud to meet you. So honored to meet you, Mr. Abbott. And he just looked at me and said, can you swing a bat? Yeah, of course I can. Of course. He goes, well, the guy we got for the movie, I forget his name. And I said, Tab Hunter? And he goes, yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. Well, he couldn't swing a bat. And I said, oh, but I can do that. What would you like me to sing? And then he says, well, you look like a baseball player. I said, no, but what would you like me to sing for you? And then he looked at me and said, if Angelo said you can sing, that's good enough for me. I'll see you first day rehearsals. So I got the job without even opening my mouth. And from that, it was with, God bless him. He, Hoop, Oh my God. He just passed away recently. He played the devil. Allison Reed played Lola. And he was 99, and he was there every day before all of us got there. And at the time, it was very old school, because of course he wrote the damn thing, so he knew it. So he would give us line readings, and we thought, oh, it's so weird. And so, you know, because that's, so I thought, we all thought, I thought it was not the way I normally work. But sure enough, when I got on the stage at Paper Mill and did it the way he wanted me to do it, that's how it worked, that he was right. So I remember him writing on a poster to a grand actor, George Abbott, which was amazing to me. And then from Mr. Abbott, he turned 100, and then who was in charge of his big celebrations but Hal Prince. So that's how I met Hal. And then from that, Hal called and said, Kevin Gray was playing Raoul at the time on Broadway, and Hal pulled Kevin out to do Kiss of the Spider Woman workshop. Mm-hmm. And so he called and said, get Davis to play Raoul. So I didn't have to audition for Halligan, but I had to go down to the village. They were Cameron McIntosh was casting Miss Saigon or something. So I had to go into a Miss Saigon call and sing All I Ask of You for Cameron McIntosh. And he goes, okay, you got it, fine. So I played that for 4 months until Kevin came back. And then I broke my ankle jumping off the bridge in Phantom as Raoul. So at the very end of the 4 months. But I had my ankle fixed, and then they called to audition for Phantom and to replace Michael Crawford here in Los Angeles. And it was between me and it was between me, and I didn't know at the time, but me and David Cassidy. And so Hal walked on the stage and said, after I finished, he went first, I went second. He said, do you want to go to LA? And I went, yeah. And so that started the whole thing. And
so wearing a mask is nothing new for you.
Meaning the character.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone's complaining about wearing a mask these days.
Oh, I get it. I get it.
Yes.
Foul fellow the fox. Yeah. No, yeah. No, but that's why I don't like Halloween, because we dress up for a living. I don't want to have to do it on, you know, with it.
So, do you know I'm the same way?
You are?
Yes. No. I said it. I did it for years.
I don't do it anymore. Years. They have to pay me to do that. So, yeah. So from that, it just bounced along like that. And then after 6 years of Phantom, I was playing it on Broadway. Hal calls up and said, Andrew and I want you to be in our new musical. And I went, what? And yeah, we're working together for the first time and since 10 years since we directed Phantom, and we want you to be in it. And I said, well, what can I say? Once again, what can I sing for you? He goes, is there anything you can't sing? And I said, oh, I'm sure there is. He goes, eh, don't worry about it. Just stick in Phantom, we'll pull you out. So sure enough, they pulled me out to do Whistle Down the Wind, which I thought was going to be my big originating a role on Broadway, but didn't work out. But Hal and I remain friends, and it's great. That's,
well, I want to go back to something that you said about, Mr. Abbott, when he came in and he would give line readings. When you work with someone like a Mr. Abbott, or you come into a role that has been originated by someone else, and you also work with someone like Carol Channing, who was a stickler for things being done the way that it was done. As an actor, you're stepping into these iconic roles with these legends, knowing exactly what they want. What kind of training or what advice do you give to other actors who may have a little discomfort in terms of stepping into those shoes that want to be able to branch out a little bit? Because you and I both know how Miss Channing felt about bringing your own style to it. And was that an easy transition for you?
I would say you have to make it, whatever it is, you have to make it your own. You can't copy anyone else. And I've been lucky. Hal never wanted me to copy any. He was open to me bringing new stuff to the Phantom. And he would say to me, like, I've never seen it done that way before, but I like it. Do it. So he was open to that. I never saw, of course, Charles Nelson Reilly play Cornelius, but I never felt I had to copy anybody. The blocking was what the blocking was. But when I went into with Carol, I knew that I just, first, I couldn't, I had to just stand back and let her do her thing. So I think she understood that I was there to support her. And luckily, we had this great chemistry that worked. And we were funny together. So I think she respected me as much. I just gave her.
Let me back up for a moment.
Yes.
Carol very much respected you. She absolutely loved you. And I know that for a fact. You were absolutely one of her favorites to work with.
She knew that I let her, she was a star and I wasn't. I was just like a supporting person, but I knew that I had to give her that area to do her thing and wait. And I learned so much, you know, about timing and comedy and from her and just watching her. And so, and I was watching stuff last night, that thing on, it's on the internet, our version of it. And when she teaches me to dance, and it's just, it just makes me tear up to see that. But I just supported her. And I don't know if I told you this last time we talked, but our first stop was on the tour was in Detroit. And back then the reviews came out the next day. And we had a show, matinee or something. And I remember the paper said, Davis Gaines as Cornelius Hackle, rivaling even the great Channing for attention. And the so I thought, okay, I'm gonna be fired today. Sure enough, I was in my dressing room. There was a knock at the door. I think it was Tiv. I think it was her dresser.
Tiv. Oh, gosh.
Miss Channing would like to see you in her dressing room. I go, oh, shit. So, oh, my God. So I took the long walk to Carol's dressing room. I walked in and she was, Davis, we've read the review. And I've already called Jerry. I went, oh, shit. And we just wanted to say how proud and happy we are that you're in our company. And I went, oh, my God. From that moment on, she knew that I wasn't a threat, but that I was a good part of the show. And so, that's how we went. The very first stop, it could have gone either way, but it was good.
But you remained, remained friends to the very end. I mean, when her 90th birthday at the Pantages Theater, I was there for that celebration, her getting into her dolly gown again.
I have it on tape. I took it that night from the side, but she was going through her speech about the Actors Fund and the Harry Collegian Foundation. Right. And she went up on her words, and all she could remember was, Davis Gaines as Cornelius Hackle. Like, she kept calling my name. And then in the middle, she stopped again. And she goes, and Davis's parents came all the way from Florida. Like, all she could remember was me and my parents that were there. So she was great. I remember, like, years later, she was doing a benefit in San Francisco. And she had to go out there at the end, of course. And she had to say some lines over, she had to learn something. So she was petrified that she was going to forget. So I ran lines with her backstage. It's like, you do fine, Carol. I said, Carol, you know what? You don't have to say a word. Just walk on the stage and they're going to go freaking nuts. Just do it. And sure enough, she just walked on and they went berserk, you know? And so it was me telling her, like, oh, don't worry. You're going to be fine. Just go out there. They're going to love you. It's like, it's crazy.
And, you know, it amazes me because I did a couple of benefits with her with the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus and everything. And to stand in the wings with her before she walked out on stage and for her to still have those kind of nerves before she walked out on stage. And, you know, and of course, the moment she stepped out on stage, it was pandemonium.
Yep. Always.
you know, and she didn't have to say a word. And then she would say, "You dear, dear people," and the the audience was right there.
Yep.
Yes, yes. So I, and again, you know, same thing with her. What are some of the life lessons that you learned from Carol Channing? I mean, obviously the discipline.
Oh, well, the discipline in the show must go on and never sick. You don't call in sick. You're there even if you don't feel good, and you know, you show up. And it's a professional thing. I mean, it's like, it's, you take it really, really seriously. This is your job. And even in Phantom, like, you know, felt such a responsibility every night for the people that, you know, had never seen it before. And it was on my shoulders, or, you know, it was, I had to show up and do my best every night.
Since you started in this business, we're going to do a little show and tell also. Also, okay. You were going to show me your favorite photograph of you and Carol. Okay. And I was going to show you one of mine.
Let me just tell you one quick thing that I just remember. You said you watch people growing up and then you meet them and you know them. I haven't posted this on my YouTube channel yet, but I have footage of this. You know, Carousel with John Raitt was at the Majestic Theater, the boards that I walked on. Oh. With. So, I mean, John Raitt was like my, you know, that's my idol as I was growing up, all the recordings, you know, all that stuff. And so when I was Phantom out here, he was in his 80s, maybe, I don't know. We did concerts together, John Ray and I.
Oh, my God.
So I have recordings of us singing If I Love You as a duet, Hey There as a duet. So I'm going to put them on my YouTube channel. But
oh, that's amazing.
The fact that I, as a kid, playing, you know, records of him on Broadway, at, who knew, I didn't know the Majestic from, you know, nothing, but... And then here I get to sing with him. It was like, it blows my mind. But yeah, back to Carol. John Raitt.
Yeah, that's great. So you're going to show you a photograph of you and Carol.
I am. Okay. So this was backstage at Phantom in Los Angeles, I think. And
this is, oh, I love this.
I love you. Sweetheart. Then... I had a big party at Warner. I rented out the New York street at Warner Brothers Studios for my, when I became LA's longest running Phantom, invited her. And this is the picture from that day, that night. And she wrote, "My dearest spiritual son, you have always held my love. And now I'm learning from you, your adoring mother."
That's great. That's wonderful. Well, of course, with her, you know, 5,000 performances, 2,000 performances for you, you know, and of course, I mean, Carol had her stock answers. Sometimes the answers changed that she would say when people would ask her about keeping it fresh and doing it. You know, for yourself, what was the secret for you going out there each night and doing it?
Richard, you asked really good questions. You're really good at this.
Well, I try.
More often.
Don't tell me, tell everybody else. Thank you.
You know, it's the actor thing in me. Like, I think that I learn something new every night. I mean, if I track my Phantom performances from the very first one to the 2000th and 15th one, it was not the same performance. It evolved incrementally, and I hopefully got better and better. I think in the beginning I learned from Phantom that I was too much. It was just too physical, too wild, man. And then as it went on, it became very much more subtle. So just the tilt of a head or just one movement would read better than being all over the place. But there were like plateaus in the years. So it was a personal thing. A year in, I went, that was my personal best tonight. Then a year and a half later, I went, no, now that's my personal best. There was always more a goal. It was always a goal to get better and tell the story clearer. And that was the goal. So you could change little things every night and make it interesting for me. And also as in a growing thing, it's like, oh, wait a minute, that's better than that I did last. That's a different way of doing it. But it didn't really change. If the audience saw it the night before, they wouldn't notice, but it was alive for me every night. Mm-hmm. It was alive. Yeah, I didn't just walk. You can't just, I never did the same thing twice. But there were some Christines that I played opposite. There's many Christines, probably 13, 14, but mm-hmm. there were some that were like robots. And then there were some that you looked in their eyes and they were like me. They were organic and there was stuff going on, the call and response thing. But I just kept trying to get better.
And I want to ask you about certain pivotal moments in your career. Your first time on a Broadway stage, were you able to really, drink in that moment? That little kid from Orlando having that dream of being on a Broadway stage, and here you are. Were you able to enjoy it, or was the adrenaline and all the excitement of being on stage, did that take over to the point where you weren't really able to be in the moment of really experiencing it until perhaps you were taking your curtain call?
No, my first, I guess, Broadway thing was Camelot and Richard Burton. And I just was just thrilled to be the 34th spear carrier from the left. I just was... Nah. And get to know him and watch him work every night. And he became a friend. And he, luckily, the director, I happened to be in rehearsal, I guess, the closest, night next to him in a blackout where he had to change. And someone had to take his crown and his cape off. So he goes, you do that every night. So every night in the dark, I would... take his crown, and he would talk to me like, "How was your day?" I said, "It was good." And we would have this conversation while I was in the blackout. And then, like, I left the show to do a Best Hello Whorehouse, I think, in Texas or something.
With Alexis Smith,
sweetheart. And so when they said, "I hear you're leaving us," I went, "I know. I'm so sorry." But he knew everything, and. I had a party at my apartment in Dallas once, and he came to the door with a six-pack of tab and a turkey and told stories till like 3 o'clock in the morning. And it was amazing. Amazing.
And same thing with Carol Channing, that first time that you're actually on stage with her.
Oh my goodness. I mean, first of all, that role is I love playing Cornelius. I love it. And to do it with her was just amazing. Mm-hmm. And then we got to take it to my hometown of Orlando. And that was like just the stage in Orlando where I did my grew up going to see theater, growing up going to see the symphony, growing up in my first tap recital. That's another whole story I can tell you. But
and I can only imagine her curtain speech that night.
It was great. It was the same every night, but my mom and dad had a party up with the cast at my house, and she came to my house. And, she was back before then, she was not eating normal food. But by then, she kind of was. So my mom, they had barbecued ribs or something, and she loved them. So my mom would send her, on the road after that, she'd send her ribs. And every time, she never forgot, as long as she lived, that, "How's your mom and those ribs? I love them." So she would always ask about my mom, Stella, and she never
forgot. When she was in, when she opened at Feinstein's at the Regency, I met with her and Harry the next morning. And I said, "I want to take you to breakfast. Where would you like to go?" And she's, "Well, if truth be known, I'm partial to Subway." And I said, "I'm not going to take you to Subway." I said, "It'll be in all the papers. Richard Skipper takes Carol Channing to Subway." Subway.
I told you that story about spending the weekend with her in Palm Springs, just the two of us. And this is before Harry. Before Harry.
I stayed at that. That was the bungalow before she moved to.
It was on a golf course, a two-bedroom apartment on a golf course. And, I got up the first morning and I made breakfast for us, and she was eating. She was, "This is delicious. Like, how do you know how to do this?" And I said, "Carol, it's just scrambled eggs." Like, "Well, I don't cook." And like, "Okay, so whatever." So I was washing the dishes, and she goes, "Let's go swimming." And I said, "Oh, darn, it was like 112 outside. I didn't bring a bathing suit." She goes, "I'll call my friend Gary." And I hear her on the phone going, "Gary, Davis needs a bathing suit." And she goes, And then she goes to me, "He says he only has a Speedo."
I know the story.
No, I'm not wearing a Speedo. I'm sorry. I'm not. She goes, "What is a Speedo?" I said, "You know what I'm saying? I'm not putting a Speedo and walking across the golf course and going swimming with you." So we did go swimming, but I didn't wear a Speedo. But she wore she came out in a bright yellow bathing suit with a hat that was gigantic and yellow fuzzy slippers. And we walked across the golf course and swam. It's amazing.
Oh, I mean, there's so many stories. I mean, just fine. She called me one time and she said, "I woke up this morning and I realized I've never fried an egg." But God bless her. God bless you, Carol. I mean, this is.
Oh, let me see. Oh, that's awesome.
I love this. You know, just the best. Just adore her. That's when I interviewed her at Barnes & Noble.
Mm-hmm.
Just a great, great night. I want to ask you what role out of all the roles that you've done was the hardest for you to let go of?
Wow. I don't have a problem letting go. I miss doing them, but I don't carry things really with me. But some are more personal, some are more fun, some are more, you know, the last thing I think I just played was Nostradamus in Something Rotten, which is just a crazy fun.
Mm, mm.
But, you know, then there's Phantom and then there's Don Quixote, which is, I think, I can't decide, but I think Don Quixote is probably the most rewarding role I played it 3 times. And my dream is to revive it on Broadway. Right before the pandemic started, I was talking with people to get the rights to do that again, but we'll see. But
we'll just put it out there. It's going to happen.
Okay.
And I'm going to be there on opening night.
Will be. I'll get you. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
Speaking of opening, Carol invited me to the closing, her last performance of Dolly at the Lunt. The last time she ever did it, I think. She got me house seats. She gave me. And I was sitting on the aisle and this man came up to me. He was sitting here across the aisle. And he came up to me and says, "Are you Davis Gaines?" I went, "Yeah." He goes, "Hi, I'm Frank Rich." I went, "Holy shit." After all those years of reading him, I had never met before. Anyway, I remember we were all standing up at the end of, you know, the standing, long standing ovation. I looked over and there were tears running down Frank Rich's face as there were mine. But it was like, it was electric. Her last time is amazing.
Had you seen her do Dolly before you did Dolly with her?
No.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it was very interesting. I mean, Leroy Reams has talked about, you know, I mean, the first time that she did Dolly, she was 41.
Amazing.
And when that last time, which I also saw, she was 72.
Wow.
I think. So imagine, you know, that a lifetime of having played that role. And, you know, and of course, the challenges of life are different.
But the depth of her performance, the speech about before the parade passes by, it has to have more, it has to be richer. You know, as you evolve in life, playing, you can't play Don Quixote when you're, you know, you can when you're 18, but when you're old enough to know things and know life and how fragile it is, and yeah, it has to inform your performance, I would think. Yeah.
So what's next for you?
Next, well, I haven't had a job since since we shut down 2020, but I'm lucky. I'm going to do in my hometown next in February, January, February. I'm doing production of The Fantastics, and I'm playing El Gallo. And when I was right out of college, I played Matt, the boy, and now it's come full circle again. And I'm excited to go to Orlando again. And this company, it's the Orlando Shakespeare Theater, I've done Les Mis there and Spamalot and La Mancha there. So it's kind of the homecoming thing. And it's a job for the first time in a long time.
God bless you and God bless Dad. And of course, Man of La Mancha in New York at the Majestic Theater after Phantom. Just before we close out, I mean, this is my homage to James Lipton inside the Actors Studio. Just some random questions that I put together just for the fun of it. What are the things that you like most and least about the business as it is now? And of course, pandemic put aside.
I feel like I've been out of the loop so much because I live in LA and I miss New York so much. And I think I would probably work more if I lived in New York, but I think the business now that I hear about is all about the social media thing and how many likes you have and how many people follow you. And I don't really, I know I should care about that, but I don't.
But you're not really a Facebook person, are you?
Facebook page, but you know, I have a business page. I put all my appearances and stuff on there and my life, but not personal stuff. I don't have a personal page. People can DM me, whatever you call it, on my Facebook page, but I don't really post my family. I don't post personal things or what I feel about politics, God forbid, or whatever. I just put the show business stuff. Mm-hmm. Or, I just sang at the Dodger game the other day. I posted the anthem. But now I hear that people, casting directors, like they pay attention to how many followers you have. And you get the job over someone that doesn't have a Twitter account or a Instagram account. So that's way different than it was before. I mean, I don't have Instagram or Twitter.
It's a shame. What would be the worst thing to be reincarnated as, aside from a human being?
Ooh. You mean like an animal?
An animal, a thing, anything.
I guess a rock, a boulder that wouldn't move, that doesn't move.
And the best thing?
Bird.
Okay. What would you say is the least appropriate thing to pray for?
Oh my God. I was telling my friend Rita last night, I was in a show. I was cast in a Broadway show. We were rehearsing down at 890. It was called Roboni. And it was the first, well, I'm sure it's happened before, but we closed in rehearsal. We never even made it downtown. Uptown. But I remember getting in this prayer circle before the rehearsal, and this producer or director guy said, "Let's pray that when no one gets a parking ticket today." And I went, "Really? I mean, come on." And then I know. Then I stepped out of that circle for the rest of the time. I said, "This is bullshit." So you just can't pray.
And the flip side of that is, what is the most appropriate thing to pray for?
When I pray, I don't really I put positive thoughts out, and just that. I remember Oprah had this mantra that I use sometimes about my heart is open to you. Comes, universe, or my heart is open to you. Come sit in my heart. So it's just like. And that's, it seems to me my whole life, Not that it's been easy, mind you, but I always think that something's going to come around the corner. Something's going to happen. Something's going to be better. And I've been listening to Barbara Cook sing Something's Coming on that last album. Mm-hmm. So great. And that's how I've always felt in my life about, without any expectations or any real hope, but I've lived my, again, I've been broke. I'm kind of broke right now, but you know, you think, okay, I'm going to get, there's something coming, but I don't know what it is, but.
That's wonderful. And let's see, who in this business do you admire the most now that you've never worked with that you would really love to have the opportunity to work with?
Well, you know, I've always admired, you know, back in the, well, it's been a while, Kevin Kline's career, because he was like a transition from the Broadway to the movies and stuff like that. I always admired that he could do that and would do that. But I did meet him once. We did Katie Couric had this great benefit for her colon cancer charity at the Waldorf years ago. And it was the entire West Side Story score with the full orchestra. And she had people sing different numbers. So there was like Beyonce singing somewhere. There was Josh Groban singing Maria. There was me and Rebecca Luker singing Night. And there was Whoopi and Cheetah and Rita singing I Feel Pretty, and then there was everybody, and Kevin Kline was in it, and it just everybody you can think of. It was amazing. So I, you know, got to meet him, but there's so many people like leading men that have gone on to do things.
That's great. Different things. What tests your faith in a higher power the most these days? What test your power in a what test your faith in a higher power the most these days?
Certainly been tested in the last 18 months, but and sometimes I try to stay positive, but sometimes it's difficult. I just try to like put it out there once again, and that I, you know, definitely gone down to the get back, but I always kind of, I'm an optimist kind of, and I always think things will be better somehow.
Who is the closest person to an angel that you've ever known?
Oh my goodness. Well, talking about Rebecca Luker, she sang like an angel, and she was a dear, dear friend, and we got to do so many amazing things together. When I was Raoul on Broadway, she was Christine with me, and we recorded at Abbey Road a lot. We sang at the Hollywood Bowl across the street together, and she was a sweet soul. I mean, I really miss her. Everybody does, and that's the first person that just came to mind because her voice was like an angel to me.
I agree, absolutely. And you may have just answered my last question to you, but what is the most spiritual experience that you've ever had?
Singing at Carnegie Hall, it was like a church. I felt like I was in church. I felt I wasn't really nervous, and I think it was Skitch Henderson conducting the thing, and I just walked out there, and I just like it was just a calming feeling, and so wow, this is church to me. You know, it was beautiful.
That's great. Now, we are going to sign off in a moment, but before we do that, we agreed that we were going to do a little show and tell.
All right. Well, I'd show you my pictures.
No, but you had an item that you were going to show.
All righty.
We both have something that belonged to Carol.
I need to ask you.
You go first, and then I will show you mine.
So, there was an auction in Palm Springs for the Carol Collegian Harry thing, and my friend Rex Smith was there, and they were auctioning off Carol's stuff. She was there. But so he was bidding on the same thing, this hat. And he would bid, and then I would have to outbid him, and he would bid. It was a thing. So I finally got it. And then afterwards, I went up to Carol to have her sign it for me. And she goes, oh, Davis, I didn't know you, but I would have given that to you. And I went, oh, shit. So I paid all this money for the hat. So she signed it on the ribbon.
That's great.
But when they auctioned it off, they said it was from her original role in the review. You know, the review she did, her first original review.
Yes.
What was it called?
The Gladiola Girl. In Pioneer.
Yes, but didn't she do a nightclub act later on in her life that she...
She wore? Did that, and that's it. But that's her hat. I was going to show you something else, but since you've got a hat, this is her Cecilia Sisson hat.
Oh, my God. I just played that last night.
For did
my
you friend. Really?
Yes. And there she signed... To Richard. So we both have our hats from Carol.
If everybody has not seen Cecilia Sisson's, they have to go on in line and look at that.
It's so amazing. I'm gonna share one story with you, and then I'm gonna my closing remarks. And before we go, I was performing down in Punta Gorda, Florida, and most people know this. I performed for 20 years as Carol, and I was performing down in Florida. And a note was sent backstage from this man who said that his granddaughter, who was 10 years old, could do a perfect Cecilia Sisson. What? So I said to the stage manager, please bring them backstage. So this little girl comes backstage and I said, how do you know Cecilia Sisson? And she said, I learned it off of YouTube. And I said, well, I'd love to hear it. And she started to do... My name is Cecilia. I can't do it as well. My name is Cecilia Sisson. And she started to do this, and she was dead perfect. And I said, hold on. There's someone who has to hear this. And I called Carol. And I said, Carol, I am getting ready to go on stage. There is a little girl backstage, and she is doing a perfect Cecilia Sisson. And Carol said, that's impossible. The only other person who can do it better than me is my cousin, Dickie.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, because it's a family trait. I said, well, you've got to hear this little girl. Well, of course, the little girl doesn't get the enormity of what's going on. But the grandfather is having a heart attack in the corner, that his granddaughter is on the phone doing Cecilia Sisson for Carol Channing. But Carol loved it, and she never forgot the fact that I called her.
That's amazing.
Little girl to do this.
Before we had phones, you could have recorded that. That would have been amazing.
I wish that I did at that moment, but don't go anywhere for a moment. I want to thank everybody for being here. Sure. Davis, sure. I love you so much. It means the world to me that thanks, you man. Said yes to doing this today. But thank again, you. Don't go anywhere for a moment. Okay. I want to thank you all for being here today. I don't take for granted that you could have been anywhere else for the last hour. And the fact that you decided to spend an hour with us means the world to me. Again, if this is your first time here, please subscribe to Richard Skipper Celebrates. Not only do I believe in celebrating everyone's body of worth, but not only Davis today, but check out the other people that I've already celebrated and the ones that are coming up, the ones that are ahead of us. If you did indeed like today's show, please hit the like button, leave a comment, and share this with your friends. It's all about building that audience. And if you do leave a comment, that will elevate this show to a higher audience. And also, just tell your friends, let everyone know that I'm here. That's how everyone will find me. I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. Go to your Facebook friends list and reach out to the sixth name that pops up and reach out with a phone call. Not an email message, not a text message, not a private message, but a phone call. And let that person know what they mean to you. As my dear friend David Friedman says, we're all in this together, but we're not in the same boat. And I always say, if you're going to be out in a boat, make sure that you bring a skipper along.
There you go.
I'm going to leave the screen. And Davis, I'm going to give you the final word. Anything that you want to say about anything that we talked about today that you want to build upon, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish we had, or just any message that you want to put out to anyone who's watching right now. I thank you for the gifts that you've given to the world, the gifts that you're going to bring to the world, including that massive Broadway production. I believe it. I see it. It's going to happen. Man of La Mancha, starring Davis Gaines on Broadway. Actually, Davis Gaines in Man of La Mancha on Broadway. That's how it's going to happen. I'm going to leave the screen. It's all yours. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Man, I really hate doing this kind of stuff. I hate talking about myself, and I appreciate you asking me to be on your show and caring so much about people. I would kind of just build on the fact that reach out to people. You never know what people are going through. I think we judge people too quickly about how they look or, you know, what they're going through. What we judge people before knowing what's going on in their lives and the struggles that they're going through. And I think everyone struggles, everyone. So just kind of put yourself in other people's shoes before you judge, and just be kind and pass on the love to people, and everything will be fine after that. Thanks so much, Richard. Appreciate it.